Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is the Insurgent Radio Network with your host, Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger. Tommy is in the bunker, and all systems are go. So, as they say in Hollywood, it's on with the show.
Right here in the bunker today, right here on a beautiful day here in the Midwest on the 9th of April 2014. Yeah, how about that? I don't know what the hell this day is signifies. I've heard rumors. Anyhow, we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for our 6 days a week radio show, 1 hour a day. Absolutely. Come rain or come shine, most of the time. That's right. And if you're ever around this parts, visit Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern Steakhouse, where we rock out all the time with our, well, we got all kinds of stuff. We got hillbilly bands, we got heavy metal bands, we got crooners, we got a little bit of everything out here. And then while you're here, you can, especially while you're half drunk, you can go out to our weapons of mass destruction used equipment yard and spend more money than you should, but anyhow, a few drinks will help that out. And we're about ready to open up. Yeah, we closed all winter. We worked all winter back in the barn patching these damn weapons of mass destruction up. It seemed like they're getting to be more shot up all the time by the time we get them, but can't gripe too much because we get them for 10 cents on the dollar, man. 10 cents on the dollar, we get our Chinese friends and their junks to bring them in here and bring them up the Mississippi on those barges and get them up in on the Ohio and then on the Tippecanoe, and pretty soon they're on up here and right in my backyard under color of darkness. Right. Well, that's enough of that poppycock. Anyhow, we Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And don't forget to get on the internet and comment on these news stories, because there's hundreds of them all the time from all different kinds of websites and newspapers and New York Times, all of them. And you can get on there and you can comment and put some good stuff on there. And if you do it right, you're going to not get kicked off. You can be pretty bold on your comments, and they're accepted. Every chance I get, I put a comment in there. If everybody that says, "Hey, I believe in a lot supremacy." What was his name down south that used to get on the Howard Stern show? His name escapes me. In fact, he's escaped me. I haven't heard from him in years. Danny Carver, that's who it was. Hello out there, all you white people. I'm a white supremacist. Yeah. Anyhow, you can get on and comment all over the place. And I commented yesterday to the Bismarck Tribune. You know, a lot of you guys out there should, you know, send them a letter out there to the Bismarck Tribune, letters to the editor. And even though we know Craig Cobb went off the rails and he hasn't done what he should do and all that, but still, I'd like to see him get out of North Dakota there with his skin, you know. You never know, he might be of value sometime in the future, I don't know, but we'll see. We'll see. Okay. Now, I was scanning the frequencies about, what was it, about 12:30 last night, and on the satellite, and I picked up an interview. What was that gal's name? She sounds like she's 90 years old, but she's actually only about 40 or 50. But anyhow, I'll remember it as we go along. There's a fellow written a new book called about John Wayne. All you want to know about John Wayne? And anyhow, there's some really good information on there that I bet you a lot of you people, a lot of you younger people don't know about. You might want to go back and pull out the movie The Searchers, because John Wayne's a hardcore Mongol-hating cowboy, man. And the Indians, as they used to do a lot, they used to kidnap young kids, white kids, take them out and either brutally tear them apart and rape them, or force them into the tribe. For all those Mongol lovers out there, boy, I'll tell you, people are funny. You know, during the period of time when that was happening, people were ready to go out there and anywhere they could and grab an Indian and hang him from a tree. But 100 years later, oh my, they're wonderful cultural people, and they abided by the environment and all that, which is nonsense. The Mongols used to waylay a herd of buffaloes, maybe hundreds at a time, and drive them off into canyons just to get a little bit of use out of the dead buffalo, and hundreds of them would lay there and rot. So all this nonsense about the environmental Mongol is a bunch of bullshit. And when anybody ever starts talking to you about that, say, hey, go down and get the book out of the library or wherever you can get it, The Crimson Prairie, about what the Indian, what the Mongols were really like. Well, in this movie, The Searchers, they asked John Wayne to go out and bring these kids back that have been kidnapped and raped and everything else, and he goes out and he's loving it because he's wanting to get those bastards. Anyhow, I've got a clip from this interview. I edited a little bit, as a little bit of tidbit of information. I think I've told you before that I crossed paths with a lot of historical people in my day. You know, it's sort of strange. I used to date a gal in L.A. when I first went to California, and her roommate was dating Pat Wayne, John Wayne's son. So on at least a couple of occasions, I got to meet and talk to Pat Wayne over at this girl's house. Incidentally, this girl had a strange occupation. She designed freeways. So I was dating a gal that designed freeways for a while. But anyhow, there was the one incident of Pat Wayne. And then a good friend of mine by the name of Stan McDade, who was a good old Scotchman, and he ended up going back to Scotland to live out his life. He's probably gone now. But Stan McDade was involved in a National Association to Keep and Bear Arms, and so was I. And he ran for sheriff of San Diego County as a write-in. He didn't do too well, but at least he did it. And I worked with him on that campaign a lot against the incumbent Sheriff John Duffy. Well, anyhow, Stan McDade used to be the skipper for John Wayne's yacht. I guess John Wayne had a pretty big yacht, and he sailed down to Mexico all the time. He liked Mexico, and he hung out down there quite a bit. He even supposedly owned a hotel down there. He used to go down to, I think it was Puerto Vallarta, and watch the guys jump off the cliffs and stuff. I think that's on this tape. So without further ado, let's listen to this clippity-clip.
I like the sight of a girl coming through the fields with the sun on her hair, kneeling in church, a face like a saint.
Saint indeed.
And now coming to a man's house to clean it for him.
But that was just by way of being a good Christian act.
I knew it was Mary Kay Danaher. And it was nice, sir.
Not at all.
Now, you know, Scott, I spoke with Maureen O'Hara back in 2004 on this program, and we talked just a little tiny bit about what she whispered to John Wayne at the end of that movie, Searchers. Tell me about that movie.
Well, it's an amazing, it's probably his greatest performance, I think, that or Red River, perhaps, because it's his bravest performance. He's playing a dangerously unbalanced racist, and at the same time, he's the only man who can get the job done. And what I find so ennobling about the performance is he doesn't separate himself from the character. When actors play someone that's a little that's they're not really comfortable with, or that is really reprehensible, they often try to put distance between them. They try to be charming, or they smile a lot, and they do this. They do all these little actor tricks to make you like them in spite of the horrible things the character does. Wayne doesn't do that.
Did you see Debbie?
No. No, but I saw Lucy, all right. She was wearing that blue dress and she
What
was...
you saw wasn't Lucy.
Oh, but it was, I tell you.
What you saw was a buck wearing Lucy's dress. I found Lucy back in the canyon. Wrapped her in my coat. Buried her with my own hands. Thought it best to keep it from you.
Oh. Did they... What was she...
What do you want me to do? Draw you a picture? Spell it out? Don't ever ask me. As long as you live, don't ever ask me more.
That powerful voice.
Mm-hmm. And the way it quavers at the end of the line when you realize he's very close to tears himself. It's a blast for his performance. He just opens the door. And because the script is strong and Ford is functioning at the highest level, it's a great, great picture.
And you're listening to the Diane interview with Playboy magazine in 1971. He says some things. He says, I believe in white supremacy until the blacks are educated to a point of responsibility. I don't believe giving authority and positions of leadership and judgment to irresponsible people. I don't think we did wrong in taking this great country away from Native Americans. Our so-called stealing of this country from them was just a matter of survival. There were great numbers of people who needed new land, and the Indians were selfishly trying to keep it for themselves. I would think the fallout from those comments had to have lasted for decades.
Oh, sure. It sealed his reputation as a antediluvian dinosaur in amber, really. Certainly amongst the under 30 portion of the population. The odd thing about the interview was he'd said a lot of those things before in print at one point, and in not obscure publications, I mean in places like Life magazine. He gave an interview to Life magazine where he said that the younger generation, referring to the reporter that was talking to him, should colonize Africa, that there's so much land there. And the native Africans weren't doing anything with it, and you know, basically he's indicating a kind of a wave of apartheid, you know, and this was just a year or two before the Playboy interview. But the Playboy interview was the one that like created this firestorm.
Why?
Well,
why?
Because.
After he's said these things mm-hmm. before.
Mm-hmm.
Why did this one in particular, do you think?
Well, partially because Life magazine, for instance, was on the downhill slide in the early 70s and didn't have the leading edge quality that Playboy did, which at the time was a hot book, as they say in the publishing industry. Esquire was also a hot book of that era. You know, magazines have waves and influence just as actors do, and they come up and they come in.
Why would he say such a thing?
Because he believed.
He believed.
Because he was a very conservative man. He was conservative in the early 30s when he was making all those crummy 3 and 5 day B-Westerns. He would get into arguments with other actors or production people. He hated Roosevelt. He hated the New Deal. and they were for the New Deal. And I mean, he was not aggressive in he didn't start the fights, you know, these arguments. But he would volubly talk about, you know, the damage he thought Roosevelt was doing to the country.
Surely.
So he was, in other words, he was conservative at a young age. It wasn't something where the semi-conventional thing is where you're a moderate liberal as a young man, and as you age and as you accrue money and property and things, you start to worry about losing it. So
but how about the people he worked with? Mm-hmm. How did they feel about his views?
Oh, there's a wonderful story about Ford.
And welcome back. Here's our first email. It's from James, who says, at the end of The Searchers, John Wayne is silhouetted in a doorway. Someone once told me there was something significant about the way he positioned his arms in that scene, with one across his body grasping the other. Can you elaborate?
Sure. It's a coded gesture to another actor in the scene, and to John Ford, too. One of the actresses in the scene, before they all disappear in the frame and Wayne is left alone in the doorway, is a woman named Olive Carey. Olive Carey was the widow of Harry Carey Sr., the mother of Harry Carey Jr. She was one of Ford's oldest friends, and Harry Carey Sr. had been one of Ford and Wayne's dearest friends, and Harry had died some years earlier. And Harry had a characteristic gesture in his westerns that Wayne had grown up on when he was a kid in Glendale. Moments of pause or moments of contemplation, he would reach with one arm over and grasp his elbow with his hand. And it's just not thinking. It's not a thinking gesture, just this kind of ruminative gesture. And as Wayne stands in the doorway and looks past the camera at the people and at Natalie Wood, who he's brought back after 7 years, he reaches over and grasps the elbow. And Olive Carey was standing behind the camera watching Duke, as she called him, perform the end of the movie. And it brought tears to her eyes because he was doing her dead husband's characteristic gesture. And then he turns around and lets go of his arm and walks out, and the door closes. But it was a gesture for Olive Carey and for John Ford, who both loved Harry Carey Sr. very much.
All right, let's go. Friend, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I was arguing in 1950, 2 days away from going to Korea, and they came on the base to do a movie called Flying Leathernecks. I spent 5 weeks, 12 hours a day with John Wayne. And in the movie, we were military. We couldn't have any speaking parts, but I spent 5 weeks with John Wayne, like I said, 12 hours a day. Hmm. I have a John Wayne museum in Bowie, Maryland.
So you thought a great deal of him, huh?
Spent 5 weeks with him, and he was the greatest person I ever met. He ate with the enlisted men. We played touch football. And usually when they do a movie on location, they bring in a trailer. He didn't have a trailer. He hung out with the guys.
Hmm.
And they had two tents there, one for my – I was in charge of 14 guys. We were the real Marines, and we were called – in the movie we're called the Mud Marines. And they had a small tent set up to feed my men and a large circus tent for the studio people. And all the high-ranking military officers would bring their wives and girls down to meet the Duke and have lunch. Well, the funny part about it is about half the time they would come down and say, where's the Duke? And he'd say, oh, he's over eating with the guys. And they weren't a...
Well, I thank you for those memories. Very special in your own mind. Now to Patricia, since you're on the air.
I have a story that I'd like to check with the author. During the 80s and 90s, I owned a little hotel in Mexico. So twice a year, my friends and I would stay in this hotel on a cliff overlooking Acapulco. The employees there said that John Wayne owned the hotel. Is that true?
Well, he was dead by that time. He died in 1979. He adored Mexico. Mexico was his favorite vacation destination. And he spent a lot of time down there.
He
did go to Acapulco. He would go there to watch the cliff divers. It was a hangout for him and a guy he liked to drink with named Jim Hennigan, who was Gwen Verdon's first husband. So it's not inconceivable, but he had a lot of investments scattered around, and a lot of investments in Mexico and in Panama, for instance, scattered around. So it's not inconceivable.
Apparently, when he died, the employee said that he left the hotel to divide it up with them. So maybe that was not a true story.
That part sounds like it might be apocryphal.
All right. Thanks for calling. Keith now to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Gary.
Yeah, hi, Diane. This is a great show as usual.
Thanks.
I was very shocked to hear those comments that you made about John Wayne and what a racist he was. And after hearing them, I just failed to see how anybody could have any respect for him.
Interesting question. One of the reasons I wrote the book is that since his death, he had come to be viewed almost completely in political terms. If a conservative was talking about John Wayne, he was the risen Christ. If a liberal was talking about John Wayne, he was a draft-dodging, warmongering hypocrite. And that was pretty much the end of the conversation. So I thought, well, okay, it's the 21st century. Anybody who's interested knows that John Wayne was conservative. Let's stop viewing him exclusively through the prism of our overheated contemporary politics and look at him in all the other roles that he played as a man. What was he like as a coworker? What was he like as a producer?
What was he like as a husband?
With his first wife, who he regarded as the finest woman he'd ever known in his life. And he deeply regretted the marriage breakup, which was totally on him. He was, as he put it, I was very young, and I thought it was part of the deal in being a young actor around Hollywood. He had various and sundry, you know, brief hit-and-run relationships outside of his marriage. And the marriage broke up. She was a very strict Catholic, and the marriage eventually broke up. And he regarded that as probably the biggest blunder of his life, because she was a superb wife, she was a superb mother, she raised the children impeccably, and he knew that he'd blown something that he really shouldn't have done. He knew that, and he would talk about that. But I thought, and to return to the original thing, I wanted to look at him in aspects without necessarily viewing his every act he did or didn't do through the prism of contemporary politics. Not shortchanging his life as a political creature. That's all in the book. But I wanted to see what he was like in all of the different roles that he took in his life and as an actor.
He won his only Academy Award playing Rooster Cogburn in True Grit in 1968. Do you think that was his best role?
I think it was a great, expansive, humorous Falstaffian performance. He brought everything to it he'd learned as an actor in the 40 years he'd been doing it. Is it the equal of Ethan Edwards in The Searchers or Tom Dunson in Red River or Nathan Brittles in She Wore a Yellow Ribbon? Probably not. It's in a more humorous key. It's a gentler kind of part. But there's something very profound about it, because the John Wayne that people still put on the list of favorite movie stars, that guy succeeds because he refuses to fail.
I mean to kill you in 1 minute, Ned, or see you hanged in Fort Smith at Judge Parker's convenience. Which will it be?
I call that bold talk for a one-eyed fat man.
Fill a bitch.
There you go. You're looking for heroes, white racist heroes. There's John Wayne. He's a good one for you. How about that? And you know they'll never remake the Searchers movie. At least they never could make it anything like the original movie, because it was obviously quite racial. And John Wayne's out there killing off these bastard Mongols that are raping and pillaging white people. So I think that's something that you'll have to rent out of the video stores or something like that to get a copy of The Searchers, but you should watch it. Because in The Searchers, John Wayne was really playing John Wayne. I thought I did that one after midnight, but I see by my records here that I recorded that or copied that at almost 11 o'clock, to be precise, last night. Now, here's an interesting fellow. He was employed by the CIA, but he's a whistleblower on the CIA. And a lot of people don't know that even though by charter the CIA is not supposed to operate in the United States, well, they cleverly use the FBI as their foil in their front. And they follow in behind. So this BS that the CIA does not operate inside the continental United States is totally false and a lie. Let's listen to a little bit of this expose on the CIA.
Took a course, and it was called, and you'll love this, I still actually, believe it or not, they gave it to me afterward, which is kind of shocking. I have a diploma that says, and it has a Central Intelligence Agency, you know, the logo across the top, and the name of the course was Information Elicitation. How about that? I mean, everybody wants one of those, don't they? What's amazing is what's going on right now. If you haven't heard about this, and I'm assuming you had to have, when you find out that the Senate Intelligence Committee has been banging on the Central Intelligence Agency, trying to understand exactly what they have been doing and what they did primarily under the Bush administration. But in case you're thinking that I'm going to sit back and talk about how horrible President Bush was and how marvelous President Obama has been, you've come to the wrong dude. I'm telling you right now, what I have seen is failure on top of failure, and then exponentially even more failure. What I expected from this president versus the last one was significant. What I hoped was significant. What I saw very directly was something else altogether. But ultimately, what the Central Intelligence Agency has had to do is come forward because of this very, very extensive report, which, by the way, we will never see as a whole. Some 6,300 pages, about 48 of them will be shown. The rest have been redacted to the point that you may get the occasional adjective, you may get the occasional verb, but you actually will get no content whatsoever. But here's what we really know. The Central Intelligence Agency misled the American people. The Central Intelligence Agency misled Congress. The Central Intelligence Agency was torturing people. Now, coming from somebody like me, how do you think I feel about that? How do you think I think about something like that? Here's what I think. I think a crime is a crime. I think that if somebody tortures somebody, it's a crime against humanity, and they should be prosecuted. How you doing with that one? You see, it's a fact. The problem that I have with it, really, in many, many ways, is this. What you get is the old Nazi defense. I hate to put it any other way, right? I was just following orders. I mean, after all, what do you do if you're the CIA case officer, my former job, right? And you're told by your boss, your boss's boss, your boss's boss's boss, that comes all the way from the Senate Foreign Relations Committee to the House Foreign Relations Committee. It goes straight to the White House. You have actually the legal experts at CIA and at the White House, and at every other level coming and saying, it is legal for you to torture these guys. We will call it something else. We will do something else, but you're allowed to do this. And the net result is the guy who has 35 people above him all signing off on it saying, it's okay for you to do this. And then you go out and do that. Is that person responsible? You would say, well, wait a second. How can he be culpable when everybody up the chain all consistently agreed? By the way, notice this wasn't just a bunch of Republicans. And for those people who think that it is, they're idiots. And for those of you who think that it was just a bunch of Republicans, you're idiots too. Because that's not how this played out. It was everybody in the room. Don't you remember not long after 9/11 where all the members of Congress stood on the steps of the Capitol and they all put their hands to their heart and they sang God Bless America and they all talked about and they were all fighting for who wore the biggest lapel pin of the American flag? That's patriotism, folks, right? So So do you prosecute the guy at the bottom, or, and this is the argument, and this is the problem, is do you prosecute the guys at the top? Do you go to the lawyers who are working for President Bush, who came up with the legal justification, and there were actually several of them, and those guys are now out in private practice, and they're professors at some of the biggest law schools in America. Those guys who came up with the legal argument and the legal justification for torturing people. And you turn around and you say, okay, what does that mean? What do you do now? Do you prosecute the guy who made the legal argument but who never touched a person? Let's think about it. There are 35 people in the way who actually never actually did it, was never in the room, and can make all sorts of arguments about how they shouldn't be culpable. And by the way, I have to tell you, as a former CIA officer, but more importantly, as a practicing criminal defense attorney, I would try that case and represent that guy, and I would win in front of a jury. I'm telling you right now, I would, because he was 35 people away. How do you possibly find him guilty of it? And then how do you possibly find the guy guilty who actually committed the acts when 35 people above him told him to do it? You see, that is the problem. That's the culpability issue. But the problem that we have is no one is ever held responsible. Now, lest you think this is simply a Republican problem, we can wash our hands of it and say, ah, it's all better now. I was at the White House when President Obama came out after he took office, and he started talking about the Abu Ghraib photos. Do you remember all of those that came out under Bush? And what we found out was he said, all of this is going to come out. All of this is going to be transparent because that's what we are. That's who we are. That's what America is. And then he came out, and there were about 10 or 15 of us in the room. And what he said was, you know what? I changed my mind. All of those photos aren't coming out either. We're going to keep them secret, which is exactly what President Bush said we should do. And at that moment, that single moment, I sat there and I thought to myself, that's it. This guy is just like the last guy. And for all of the Democrats in the room, all the lefties in the room who are outraged by what President Bush did, much of what President Obama has done on this has been nothing but the same and then some. You want to talk about this with me? 9529 calls as well about this. Because from my perspective, and there are those out there who want to look at this and simply say, this is a left versus right question. Okay, I get that. I really do. But the problem is, from my perspective, this is nowhere near a left-to-right question. Because if it were the case, then we would have expected very specific actions from the likes of President Obama after he took office. So let's be very specific about this. In terms of this question of torture and what was going on, I've spoken a lot with the ACLU about this when I was in New York at Lincoln Center, when I did this in Washington, D.C., with a lot of members of Congress when I did this, and I was involved with ultimately the documentary that came out at Sundance Film Festival. I was there for that. A big part of it was this, is that every time we addressed this issue with President Obama, here was his response. His response was, we need to stop looking back. We need to stop looking forward. And the problem is that what's the logic of that? What's the logic of saying the only way to move forward is to look forward and ignore everything that happened before this? Because essentially, that is what he has done. And in fact, if you take a look at what the Central Intelligence Agency has done and what the Senate Intelligence Committee has been working on right now, the White House has dragged its feet the entire time, has done little to nothing. In fact, in some ways, obstructed the investigation as much as anything else out of fear that they would offend the intelligence community and the military, and frequently tied very closely together because they're working on things in the future. That is a fundamental problem and one of the major issues that's going on right now. 952-946-6 on MSNBC, where all of a sudden the left can do no wrong. And I've been on there many, many times, so trust me, I understand the concept as well as most. Whereas I can take you to Fox News and they'll decide that the right can do nothing wrong and it's the left. But the problem is that in itself is a very big part of the issue. When we talk about things like this, this is not a left or right question. This is not about what the Republicans do or did or what the Democrats do or did. This is about a national identity. It's about what the U.S. stands for. And when I mean that, I mean collectively. And that, frankly, includes you. What do you stand for? And when things are done, please understand, this is done in your name. I can't contemplate the number of times when I was in Nairobi, Kenya, or whether I was in Dubai, or whether I was in Kandahar, or whether I was in Switzerland, or whether I was in Mexico, I would be approached and asked why I, me, Jack Rice, me, and I'm just like you, why we allowed this to happen, why this happened, why we it was okay for us to do this. And you know what? I actually liked it. I liked it because, in fact, we all bear responsibility, and it's nice and easy to say, well, that's not my president. I don't care where you are. I don't care who you are. I don't care whether you're an independent. I don't care whether you're an American Nazi party. I don't care whether you're a Democrat, a Republican. I don't care whether you're some sort of an anarchist, and I'm kind of sometimes there myself. And that's what I'm thinking, is that that is my president. Those are my decisions because I have to live with them. And sadly, many people have had to die because of them. Let's go to Bill in St. Paul.
About the agency, at what point did it become permissible for the CIA to operate within the U.S. itself, within our domestic borders, surveilling state governments, as Ventura has alleged he was surveilled, but also private citizens? We know the NSA has done this extensively. When did the agency really become involved in that kind of activity on our own citizens?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll take that call, and I'm going to try this right now. And this one, I'm always afraid of this, and I'll be honest with you, and here's the reason I'm afraid. The last thing I want to see is have two or three guys show up in black suits and sunglasses talking into pieces that are coming out of their wrists and going into their earpiece. That's what I don't want. But this has always been the answer, is that they never had a charter to work in the U.S., and they never had a charter to work independently in the U.S., but here's what they did do. They would actually work with the Bureau, and they would communicate with the Bureau and coordinate with the Bureau, and therefore it's the Bureau who had the lead investigative effort, and so they would hide behind the FBI, and they would run an operation, if that were hypothetically true, and I'm just saying hypothetically now, that way I want to stay out of jail, and they would run their operations behind the power and control of the FBI and do what it was that they were going to do. They couldn't do it themselves, but they would find a way to run those operations through another organization who had the legal justification to do so. Of course, the problem that would always be is oversight. How do you understand what somebody does? How do you get coordination when nobody wants to let go of it, when nobody wants to let go of the power itself? And how is the agency, the Bureau, the DOD, anybody else willing to actually do this when there is absolutely no oversight of any kind, and most importantly, no transparency to ensure that all of the rules and all of the law has actually been dealt with as it should be? That is the fundamental problem, and it's the problem we continue to face in this country to this day. My name is Jack, the renowned attorney in the country and representing veterans who are coming back from foreign wars with PTSD and traumatic brain injury and what this means. And frankly, we're talking about a tidal wave that is heading toward us that we don't even want to talk about. And I think about this in my own personal life. And by the way, just in case you're curious about how large of a tidal wave we're talking about, the expectation could be as many as 500,000 people that come back with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. The number of those who end up with the lives that are destroyed and end up in prison cells, and all of the lost opportunity, I mean that in terms of not just money, I'm talking about lives themselves. And the reason I'm talking about this is because this is a fundamental cost of war. And we are paying this price, and this will be paid for the rest of the lives of these men and women, and this includes women. He, in fact, has the only book in the nation on this topic. He's going to join me tomorrow night. You are absolutely not going to want to miss this, because him, the most leftist politician in America, when in fact that was insanity. He was so far to the right of the lefties in the room that it's not shocking that he has come down the path that he has.
Well, Jack, I know that you're a smart guy. You're a really smart guy. So I know you know what Battered Wife Syndrome is people on the left that did vote for Obama show signs of battered wife syndrome. As a matter of fact, the whole country, for the time that we were in the Bush-Cheney years, we were being beaten, thrashed, we were being lied to, we were being... our children were being sent.
Oh, wait a second, Sanchez. Are you telling me? Are you telling me? So what happened? No, hold on, Sanchez. So I'm going to make sure I understand. So what you're telling me is, after 8 years of getting beaten down by the Bush administration, we were looking for anybody who said that they loved us. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, anybody that was charming and was able to sweet talk us and using words like hope and change, which were strictly marketing. They were strictly marketing, because as soon as that man got into office, after the Lillian Ledbetter Act was made, the following day he goes and holds secret talks with coal company executives. He promised that he was going to have a transparent administration. One of the first things he did after Lillian Ledbetter was start having secret coal company executive meetings and refused to divulge any of that information, the same way Cheney was holding executive meetings in the Oval Office. So I'm sorry, Jack, but I was never convinced. I mean, you know, again, I'm a loyal listener, and I was able to put all these facts together, and I was just sitting on the sidelines. I've never voted for a Democratic Party person. I'm a third party person, going back to voting for a guy in 1980, Barry Commoner. Yeah. So I'm not attached to either party. I can see how both political parties, it's a duopoly, Jack. Both parties are being in Wall Street.
You're absolutely right, and I appreciate your call. I know Mark.
Incidentally, the name of that book about John Wayne was The Life and Times of John Wayne. I think it's just been published lately. You know, it's getting to be quite in vogue to track people's DNA. And it looks like there's so many mistakes on this DNA thing that due to unscrupulous people running it and so forth. I wonder if they've ever done a DNA on the shroud that's supposedly, allegedly by the Christians, wrapped the baby Jesus or Jesus in it. Now, I don't think I've heard of anybody doing a DNA test on that, but that would be interesting if they came up with Clyde Kiddlehopper or something like that. And there's so many of these DNA tests turning out to be phony and fake that now I'm beginning to wonder about all these black guys that were in for life without parole and all that kind of stuff in prison. And about once a week or once every couple of weeks, they're freeing a guy from prison. Almost always, as far as I know, always black, that they have found DNA evidence wasn't there to convict him and all that. Maybe this is a slick, clever way of getting these niggers out of prison, so they can go out and kill more white people. Well, if you go back this far with me, at least 10 years, maybe more than that, I told you the United States, as it becomes more so-called Latin and mestizo and so forth, and Asian too, that's going to become a knife culture. It's not going to be as much of a gun culture. It's going to be more of a knife culture. And it's catching up with us now. Police and paramedics are on the scene of a stabbing at Franklin Regional High School in Murrysville, Pennsylvania. Dan Steven with the Westmoreland Emergency Management says 20 students have been injured. Four of those are serious. A school resource officer called in the stabbing at 7:13 a.m. Forbes Hospital says seven victims have been taken to their hospital. One victim has been flown to the Allegheny General Hospital and two taken to UPMC Presley. Okay, police say the male suspect is in custody and is reported a student at the school. Three air medical helicopters were dispatched to the scene, as well as a dozen of the ambulances. According to a witness, the stabbings happened in the science wing of the building. One of the children that pulled the alarm, my daughter said, after the incident happened to clear the school. She reported to me that it was a 10th grade student. Parent Tim Graham told KDKA, and I wonder what color that kid was. Franklin Regional School District has canceled all elementary classes and say that the high school and middle school students are secured. Well, there you go. Knives are not illegal unless they're too long a blade and like that. One thing about knives, you can use them to punish or you can use them to kill. Many times in prison, they'll have the real short blades and they'll use it just to damage the guy but not to kill him, or a longer blade to kill him. But there's too many people who are not knowledgeable enough about knives or how knives and how dangerous knives are. Now, I've got these police videos. I still have them here, and they may be up on the website. I don't know. Where it showed a man 20 feet away from you and can rush you and put a knife in your chest before you could clear leather with your gun, aim, and shoot. Because cops are continually being killed by knives because they think because they've got a gun that there's no problem and they're standing too close to the aggressor. That's one thing you got to remember. If there's anybody looks like they're going to give you trouble, don't stand nose to nose with them. Stay as far away as you can to give yourself enough time to either decide to run or decide to fight. You know, it's up to you. But knives and even the girls are, for years now, in the tough areas of the cities, the blacks have hidden razor blades in their hair and in other parts of their body. And so anyhow, the blade is becoming the weapon of choice. Now here again, you can put down somebody with a blade pretty easily if you've got at least a few feet between you with pepper spray. I cannot advise more stridently carrying pepper spray, at least as a backup. Because if you've got a good quality pepper spray that'll reach out there, they've got the foggers now that'll reach out there maybe 20 feet. But with a regular pepper spray, reach out there about 8 to 10 feet, that's enough. And believe me, if a guy's coming at you with a knife and you hit him in the face or with that pepper spray, he's not going to continue, and all you have to do is sidestep because he's not going to hardly know where he's at. That way, like Donald Musgrove used to tell me, doing it that way, you don't have to fill so many papers out. In other words, if you shoot somebody, there's going to be a big investigation, and it's going to be a lot of interviewing, interrogation, and it's a long process. But if you hit somebody that's coming to chew with pepper spray, they're not even going to sight you, and you can walk on home no problem. However, I know in California, the misuse of pepper spray is a felony. So you can't just be having skinhead fun and go around spraying people in the face and not risk doing jail time. Now, I'm going to email you this story because in it, it's got a picture of all these different knives. Now, there's a lot of different knives that are illegal. You don't need an illegal knife. You don't need a switchblade and things like that because they find that on you. You're a felony. You're going right off. It won't be maybe quite as bad as a gun, but still, they're going to hammer you. There's no reason in the world why a legal length blade knife, and you know how to use it, that's the secret, you got to know how to use it, can protect you from pretty much about a high percentage of incidents where someone tries to attack you. But I would recommend that you carry pepper spray and a knife, a good pocket knife, a good legal pocket knife that can be opened pretty quickly, not a switchblade. unless you want to take the chance. I mean, you can carry illegal knives around, but if you want to take the chance, I say it's not worth taking that chance, because if you know how to use a legal knife, it'll take care of most of the problems you might run into. Women should definitely have a knife and pepper spray. Between the two, they're cutting their odds down quite a bit of being raped in some Kmart parking lot. You don't have to necessarily hit a vital spot with a knife either. I mean, a knife through a guy's hand or a woman, your aggressor's hand or anything like that, a knife in the leg. Most of the time, they're going to be looking for someplace to go real quick. Of course, if you know the femur arteries of the neck and the groin, and if you really want to put them down for good, that's where you would go, and you should memorize with a body chart where these spots are, because I remember one time there was a guy who stabbed this big fat guy 7 times, and he didn't die because the guy didn't hit the right spots. I mean, you can be knifed quite a bit and survive, but if they hit an artery, you're done. Boy, this thing in the Ukraine is something else. Here's this Ukraine outfit reminds me of Poland prior to World War II, and they were big mouth and spouting all over the place, and because the Brits were promising to pull their irons out of the fire, Poland couldn't. There was no way Poland could stand up to Germany, but they were very boastful and braggadocious while they thought Britain was going to come to their aid, and France and all those. That's what reminds me of Ukraine today. The Ukraine gives the Russians a 48-hour notice. The acting interior minister of the Ukraine, Arsen Avakov, idiot number one, has issued a warning to Russia-supported protesters that if protests in the eastern regions of the Ukraine are not resolved within 48 hours via negotiations, they will be resolved through the use of force. Russia, on the other hand, has warned that they reserve the right to protect these people. I would see here again, you've got these numbnuts in Ukraine believe in the EU and NATO, and everybody's going to come to their aid, and you got Kerry waving his arms and screaming, and we're going to get you, and Russia this and sanctions that, and I think they're going to find out that if shit hits the fan, they're going to be standing there by themselves with their finger in their butt. That's the Ukraine I'm talking about. Well, I see they came up with this cockamamie UN resolution or some kind of a treaty they're talking about to confiscate weapons. And they say, according to this right-wing scare propaganda, I don't know whether this is true or not, it says 53 U.S. senators voted against the UN gun confiscation. 46 senators sold us out. Well, you just have to get the list of all these guys, if they truly did sell us out. And I've got a whole list. I'll send them out to you. And they're mostly Democrats. Let's see if there's any Republicans on the list. This may be, a lot of this may be Republican propaganda, but and I don't think that that so-called UN treaty had much force behind it at all. I think it was more for propaganda. But in the meantime, I'll send you out the names and the states where the senators were that voted for the UN to take all my weapons, man. I'm sending this out to you, a list of these so-called senators that voted for the UN resolution to seize the arms and all that kind of stuff. I'm suspicious of a lot of stuff that comes out of the right wing, you know that. And I'm suspicious because I don't see any Republicans on the list at all. Anyhow, if you find something screwy about this deal, about this UN deal, let me know, or I may find out later, because I get a lot of this right-wing stuff in, and the right wing is, the sky is always falling, the sky is falling, you know, and a lot of it I don't pay much attention to because it's false flag stuff. I have a hard time believing that 46 Democrat senators, 46 of them, would vote for UN gun confiscation. That's a little suspicious to me. I know there's a bunch of bastards out there, but well, I see that Rochelle High School down in Georgia finally held its first school district sponsored race mixing prom. This year's Wilcox County High School event was the first district sponsored prom in over 50 years ago. In over 50 years ago, dating back to when the schools were still segregated, prior to the U.S. Supreme Court's anti-white landmark decision of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, forcing people to integrate. But despite the obvious implications, parents from the 400-student school have organized two separate segregated proms every year since, calling them white prom and black prom. Well, that's logical. No problem there. What's the problem? The school says it did not want to get involved. Last year, four female friends, two white, two black, two beautiful, two ugly, made the headlines when they merged the normally segregated proms into one that all students could attend. Whoopee! Happy days! Just like the dances before it, the prom was considered unofficial as the parents, not the school district, planned it. See, the parents are involved in all this crap. I didn't agree with the fact that they separated blacks and whites, so I just put my foot down and said, no, I'm not going to an all-white prom. That would be boring. I wouldn't be able to pick up some stud black who give me lots of sexual activity. And I'm not going to go with somebody to an all-black prom either. Well, stay home, bitch. It's just not going to happen, said a white female student who attended last year's prom with a black date. Oh, boy, she's probably had a chocolate kid by now. Love really has no color. No, lust. Lust, not love. And I want everybody to know that if you stand up for something you believe in, only positive things can come from it. Well, they never said that about Adolf Hitler. He stood up for positive things, what he believed in, added Marishika Rucker, a 2013 prom organizer. After the student-led prom received national exposure, the school caved to the pressures and sponsored its first race-mixed prom. Donations for this year's prom soon started rolling in. Yeah. These conservative Christian Republicans would rather switch than fight, including volunteering offers from Atlanta area DJs and motivational speakers to tell them how wonderful they are for race mixing. Everything went off without a hitch, said Wilson County School Superintendent Steve Smith. Well, any racially oriented white kids should just not go to either one. Prom, I remember my prom was pretty damn boring, as I recall. I got out of that damn prom as fast as I could. I had to go out and buy a suit and a whole bit. It cost me good money that I had saved to try to go to a prom and look like a fancy Dan. Yeah. I was dating out-of-town girls anyhow. What the hell was a prom to me? A school representative also tweaked... Oh, incidentally, our prom was all white. Great job, prom committee. Great decorations. DJ and turnout for the senior walk. Thank you, community, for your support. Well, I'm sure next year there'll even be more race mixed. How about that? And won't that be wonderful down there in Georgia that you parents going to put your daughters on the slave block so the nigger boys can do their thing, huh? You black student women, girls, are stupid because these nigger boys are going to be going all after the white girls and you're going to be left out in the cold. You should have kept it an all black prom, dummy. Last story of the day. Racially themed parties dubbed racist ragers have sparked controversy on campuses across the U.S., most recently at Columbia University. Sorority Kappa Alpha Theta is in deep water for the offensive photos posted online following its Beer Olympics. Event members of the sorority, as well as the fraternity Sigma Phi Epsilon, dressed in offensive, stereotypical costumes of mestizos meant to represent Ireland, Mexico, and the Netherlands, Jamaica, and Japan? That's strange. Proof of the most distasteful depiction came courtesy of Theta President Katie Barclay, who posted two photos on Facebook in which eight girls wore sombreros. Of course, Mexicans never wear sombreros. And mustaches. Well, we know Mexicans don't have mustaches. While holding mariachis and bottles of tequila, and I guess Mexicans never drink tequila, along with T-shirts of a distorted Mexican flag that read, "Down Fiesta." The university's Chicano caucus was especially insulted and released a statement, quote, "While we understand that the actions taken by these members may not have intended to be harmful, they are in fact offensive. Stereotypes are used to oppress marginalized communities." Aha. These pictures categorized Mexican culture and should not be overlooked. The attire trivializes the entire nation's history. We never wore sombreros. We always wore derbies. This picture characterizes the character of Mexican culture. No, wait a minute. I've lost my place. Though the attire was meant to represent Mexico in a game of Beer Olympics, in actuality, it perpetuates the American stereotype of a sombrero-wearing Mexican mestizo invader distorting the culture into a form of entertainment. You mean like Frito Bandito? That Frito's made millions of dollars off that guy. Quote, "That's not to say that members outside the Mexican culture cannot dress in our cultural garb or partake in our traditions. However, altering the Mexican flag is not the way to participate in a respectful manner." They weren't even genuflecting to the American or to the Mexican flag. Wow. Anyhow, that's it for today, boys and girls. They're offended. I love it when they're offended. Free speech offends everybody. That's why I'm such a supporter of total free speech. 14.5. And if they say they're offended, say, "You offend me every goddamn minute of the day. Every time I see your ugly brown puss on television, I'm offended. Apologize or I'm going to sue your ass." 14.5.